where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. One of the great questions is, where did we come from? Where did we here on Earth come from? And we have a very fascinating and accomplished guest to discuss this today, Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe. He is the director of the Center of Astrobiology at the University of Buckingham, professor of Applied Mathematics and Astronomy. He has taught at the University College Cardiff and the University of Cambridge, and he's also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Astrobiology and Outreach, and he lives in Cardiff, Wales. He's on the line with us today, and we're talking about the new book that he has done along with Robert Bavall, Cosmic Womb, The Seeding of Planet Earth. And Dr. Wickramasinghe is one of the fathers of the idea of panspermia, and we're going to talk to him about that and Cosmic Womb and the Seeding of Planet Earth. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So if someone has heard that term, maybe they've not heard the term, and they're not familiar with the concept of panspermia, which I believe is a concept that you co-invented, could you explain to people what it is and what it entails?
Yeah, let me answer the question that you posed in your introduction. Where did we come from? And I think the answer, which is now quite unequivocal, is that we came from space. So that's the short answer to the question of where we came from. It's an ancient question. It's been an age-old question. I think it's probably amongst the first questions that human beings began to ask themselves when they became intelligent and sort of civilized and so forth. So That's the sort of shortcut to the whole program, is that we came from space. But to answer your question about panspermia, it is in fact a very ancient idea. In fact, it goes back to Greek times. A philosopher by name Anaxagoras first talked about panspermia, which essentially in Greek means pans is everywhere, and spermata are seeds, so it means seeds everywhere. So that basic idea is very old, but the ideas that relate to astrobiology were basically invented by me and my collaborators in the 1980s, and my principal collaborator was the iconic astronomer of the 20th century, a man called Sir Fred Hoyle. So together we developed the idea that there is evidence for life being everywhere with the new astronomical observations that were coming in the 1980s. It was becoming more and more clear that we could not have originated, that life could not have originated on the Earth. There was clear evidence that molecules, substances that were very closely related to life was essentially distributed everywhere in the cosmos, in our own Milky Way and also further out in other Milky Way systems, in other galaxies. So this was already in the 1980s. It was becoming clear that the standard position of scientists was totally wrong. The standard position being that life had to originate on the Earth. But the biologists called a primordial soup. So this was a sort of canonical view of life, which we essentially began to overturn from the 1980s. And evidence, of course, for this new position has grown steadily over the decades and the years that followed. And now, in the year 2018, I think there's not a shadow of doubt that this is a correct explanation. However, there is still lingering resistance to people changing their mind on the issue of where life started. Scientists, certainly of my generation and maybe even a slightly older generation, have been so used to thinking and believing that life had to start on the Earth that no matter how strong the evidence that is there to the contrary, they still sort of hang on to this ancient belief that is totally bogus. We have also to blame for the sort of persistence of the wrong view. I think we also have to blame an ancient Greek philosopher, Aristotle. I think all of your listeners probably have heard of Aristotle, Socrates, Aristotle, the sort of the triad of philosophers in the 4th, 5th century. And Aristotle made many, many mistakes. He is a highly respected figure in sort of analytical philosophy, but he made dreadful mistakes. For instance, one of the mistakes he made was to insist that the Earth was at the center of the universe, at the physical center of the universe. And this was in the 3rd, 4th century BC. He made this statement and insisted that it was true. Subsequent philosophers and so on have followed in the tracks of Aristotle, believed that. And we all know that it took a huge effort on the part of Copernicus and Galileo in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries to overthrow that ridiculous position that we were at the center of the world, at the center of the solar system. But having won that victory, defeating Aristotle on that particular issue, Aristotle had another theory that he was very keen on, and that is the theory that life had to start on the Earth. He had the idea that the idea of spontaneous generation of life. He said that if you mix warm earth and morning dew, you get fireflies. And there were several sort of variants on this theme. But he, again, because he was such a revered figure in Western philosophy, it was very, very difficult to challenge his position. Even in the sort of turn of the 20th century, when there were suggestions made by a chemist called Arrhenius that life came from outside. This was very quickly sort of silenced. People said this is nonsense. Microbes cannot survive in space, and therefore Arrhenius's claim that life came from outside is to be totally wrong, and so on. So this is again Aristotle holding reign over the facts of science. And so where I came in the sort of mid, as I said, in the early 1980s, there was new evidence to essentially resuscitate the old ancient theory of panspermia. And we began to see that there was nothing at all in favor of the old idea that life started on the Earth. So this is the basis of panspermia that I've been working on. And astrobiology also was something that essentially Fred Hoyle and I coined, a word that was not in existence. It's everywhere now, of course. There's a NASA Astrobiology Center, many universities have courses in astrobiology and so on. But in the 1980s, I think with all modesty, I have to claim that my colleague Fred Hoyle and I decided that astronomy and biology had to be basically married. There had to be a marriage between these two subjects that looked so different, seemed so different to people. They had to be taken together if you're going to understand the universe properly. So that was the beginning of beginnings of astrobiology. But even after astrobiology sort of got accepted in a kind of way by universities and so on, the thesis that we came from space, that human beings and life on Earth came from space, has been vigorously resisted, even resisted up to the present day. And I find that very, very strange and a very sad commentary on human society of the 21st century. We have a huge body of facts now that cannot be explained any other way than to say that life is everywhere outside the Earth and that we are part of this grand scheme of life that is essentially cosmic life.
Now, now I have a question,
question for you.
Yes.
Is it a case where basically the idea is that all of these ingredients were in comets, they struck the Earth and actually became something just by chance, or were we intentionally seeded to be here?
Well, I think that the question of whether it was the whole process when intentional or otherwise is still open for grabs. I think that we don't have an answer to that. But the comets delivered not just the chemicals, the substances of life, but they delivered real living entities like bacteria and viruses and all the information also that was needed to develop from very primitive life forms like bacteria to the advanced life that we have, plants, animals, humans, and so on. Let me just give you one illustration. I think now there is no question that life emerged on the Earth at the very first moment that life could survive, and it emerged during a period of intense comet bombardment. Comets were comets and asteroids and meteorites were hitting the Earth ferociously some 4.2 billion years ago. And that's exactly the time when we have now hard evidence, evidence in the rocks. In Canada, in Australia, there are rock formations that have shown hard, unambiguous evidence that life was being delivered already at 4.2 billion years. And the life then was in the form of simple bacteria, microorganisms, archaea and bacteria. Now, the standard picture of evolution is that this bacterium, however it emerged, whether it was primordial soup or whether it came ready-made from a comet, it is supposed to evolve by essentially copying itself time and time and time again. Occasionally, in the copying process, there are mistakes made in the DNA is not copied precisely exactly. So occasionally a mistake is made, and occasionally the mistake is advantageous, is a good mistake, and makes for a better organism, a better suited organism, and so on. And so that's the way that evolution is supposed to take place. If that is true, it is really surprising today that we find that some 2 billion years had to elapse between the emergence of bacteria on the Earth and the emergence of what are called cells, eukaryotic cells, cells like which have nuclei and much more complex cells. So 2 billion years had to elapse for that. And again, nothing happens for another 1.5 billion years until we get this huge explosion of small animal life. And so every development of life that we see in the Earth's record is very sudden, and it comes after a huge, long period of stasis, of no activity whatsoever. So this is very fully consistent, I think, with ready-made genetic material, ready-made life forms in viruses, in the form of viruses and bacteria being sent to the Earth, when pushed to the Earth through cometary impacts. And again, I think in the last 5 years, the new discoveries of planets makes this what I call exoplanets, planets outside our solar system. There are now estimates giving a figure like 140 billion planets like the Earth in our Milky Way system alone. And so it's almost one for every sun-like star. So to maintain that this whole system is not connected in some way is just ridiculous, I think. And it's an indication of how stupid collectively our society has become.
Now, is there particularly one or more smoking gun type pieces of evidence that you would point to, whether it's in artifacts, oral traditions, not necessarily proof, but evidence that would point to this idea? And you said that over the last few years, there's been more and more of it developing. What are some of your favorite and some of the best examples in your view?
Yeah, the best example that I have at the moment is something that sort of cropped up weeks ago when a group of Russian scientists sent me data, information, saying that on the windows of the International Space Station, which is orbiting the Earth at a great distance, 400 kilometers, they have found signs of bacteria and algae that are very similar to the stuff that is on the Earth, that algae that we find in the oceans and on the surface of the Earth. Now, 400 kilometers is a height that is far too high for lifting anything from the surface of the Earth to the space station. So it is a case of the space station intercepting a continuing barrage of these materials coming from space. There's still a deathly silence on the part of the major establishments in science. It's just it's breaking news, as it were, at the moment. So that's my sort of newest kind of smoking gun. But there have been a whole lot of these at the level of sort of microscopic life forms. On the level of higher life, I think the smoking guns that I have heard about are less secure. And one of the things that Robert Beauval did in the part that he wrote for our joint book on the cosmic womb is to say that the evidence from the pyramids suggests that there may have been a visitation by an extraterrestrial intelligence at some 3000 BC that somehow contributed to the wisdom that is inherent in the building of the pyramids. Now, I keep agnostic and open mind on that because it's again very indirect kind of evidence. All of the evidence that is being provided these days for ongoing contact with extraterrestrial intelligence has been somewhat questionable, and evidence has been really not hard evidence, not unequivocal evidence. So I keep an open mind on whether there are possibilities of intelligent life somehow injecting material, injecting information to the Earth in recent times. One of the variants of the idea of panspermia was an idea that was discussed by the Nobel laureate Francis Crick to say that perhaps a super intelligence sent viruses with very sophisticated messages to the Earth, and these are still being received at the Earth. So the stuff that I said is coming in almost on a daily basis could include material that's been sent or sort of injected by an extraterrestrial superintelligence. That's a possibility that we cannot exclude, nor can we prove it in a scientific way. I would think that if we project ourselves into the future, humans project ourselves, say, 500 years into the future, we would have developed technologies that would allow us to make sort of genomes into microscopic particles and throw it out into space. So we can think of our intelligence, super intelligence that would emerge 100 years, 300 years from now, as being capable of communicating information, genetic information, maybe other types of information as well, through a deliberate act of throwing out material into space. So that's I think, a rational possibility. I think the developments that are happening now are happening at a pace that is almost incredible. We've had developments in computer technology, IT, biotechnology that would not have been dreamt of even three decades ago. So anything is possible. If you're able and willing to extrapolate from our recent experience of emerging technologies.
What you have found in the evidence you see for life coming here, what does that say about life elsewhere in the universe?
I think what we've found so far shows that life everywhere is connected at a very intimate level, at a very deep molecular level. In fact, until about maybe 20 years ago, we thought that the biosphere of the Earth, the whole living system of the Earth, was confined to the planet itself, to the surface of the planet, maybe a little bit of the atmosphere. But now we know that this is not remotely possible, because we are losing material from the Earth at a very steady rate. Stuff is coming out. We've got impacts happening from time to time over long geological periods. We have impacts like the impact that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. Now, this impact has an effect on the planet, but it also throws out material that has living material from the Earth. So we would have seeded countless other planets as the solar system, as the Earth makes its path across the galaxy, around the center of the galaxy. Our life would have been spread quite widely across the whole Milky Way system. In a similar way, because we know now, today, that there are some 140 billion planets that are like the Earth, I think all of these planets must have life that is very similar to life on the Earth. In fact, they should be connected in a like a biosphere. The whole of the galaxy is one connected biosphere. That would be my point of view.
Some people wonder about the possible, and you kind of addressed this in a previous question, of the question of some kind of intelligent design. What's your viewpoint on that in regard to the evidence that you've found that life came here from elsewhere?
I think the evidence that the argument that there has been an intelligence inherent in the universe that led to the beginnings of life cannot be ruled out at all. I mean, there's a fashion now to essentially say that this is unscientific, to talk about any intelligence that is responsible for controlling the origins of life is regarded as being outside the purview of science. I don't agree with that. I think we do not know, no matter how big the system is, the physical system, we really do not know how non-living material became living material. The odds against the simple molecules of life assembling themselves into a simplest living system, into the most primitive living system, is the odds are incredibly, incredibly small. In fact, I think my colleague Fred Hall and I have likened the transformation of molecules to life like a tornado blowing through a junkyard, putting all the bits and pieces, the little nuts and bolts together to make a fully functioning Boeing 747.
I love that.
I mean, that's something that's in the literature, and I stand by that. I think we just do not know how the first life, how the whole blueprint for life happened, even on a cosmic scale. But it happened on a cosmic scale. It did not happen on a terrestrial scale. That I am absolutely sure of. I don't know. I don't profess to know how it happened. And an intelligent design is one possibility that is certainly feasible, even though it's unpopular and regarded as being semi-religious. I don't consider that as an objection. But it's a possibility that has to be borne in mind, because there's no other explanation that appears to me to be valid or reasonable as far as modern science is concerned.
Now, and you had talked about life elsewhere in the universe, but to delve into that a little deeper, I mean, we hear about all of these Earth-like planets or potential Earth-like planets that are being theorized and speculated at, and the number seems to grow by the day. I mean, how widespread do you think life like us in some way might be throughout the universe? Are we talking two different planets? Are we talking five different planets? Are we talking 5,000 planets? Are we talking 500,000 planets with Earth-like life? I mean, what are your thoughts? Do you venture a guess?
Yeah, I think the entire planetary system, the grand total of 140 billion planets that have been talked about in our Milky Way, they are all connected into a single biosphere. So I think the number is the number of planets on which we have extensions of our life really go into that kind of billion, hundreds of billions or tens of billions at the very least. So it's a huge number. And amongst that number, I think it will be really arrogant for us to think that we are at the top of the pile in terms of intelligence. I rather think that we are at the beginning of the experiment of intelligence, or the experiment of sort of acquiring intelligence, and at the end of the road as far as intelligence is concerned may be almost unimaginable in terms of its scope. We are probably thinking of superhumans emerging on our planet million years from now, and if that is the case, then these superhumans must have emerged on very many other planets in our Milky Way system. So the possibility that these higher levels of intelligence could have communicated in some way with us remains a very, very serious possibility. And I think programs like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and so on, have to be revived in the light of the new knowledge that we have, the new knowledge that tells us that that there are so many planets that are like the Earth, so many billions of planets that are like the Earth, and that the existence of life on the Earth implies necessarily the existence of life on all these other places, all these other billions of habitats. And then the possibility that we are at maybe at the bottom of the end of the spectrum of intelligence. So we have to really consider the possibility that there's a huge amount of extraterrestrial intelligence at a higher level than us. And to search for that intelligence is, I think, one of the most exciting ventures that we have for the future. We have to do that. I think it's a human responsibility to pursue projects like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, by whatever techniques that we have available to us.
When you look at the theory of panspermia, and you mentioned the resistance in some scientific circles to take it seriously or look at the evidence, are you hopeful, or maybe a better question is, do you believe that the worm will turn, let's say, in the next few decades, that it will go from being what some might think is a fringe theory to something that's just accepted science?
I think it would. I think that the rate at which new data has been coming over the past few years even has been just phenomenal. And I told you about the discovery of bacteria on the surfaces of the International Space Station. And there are scores of other new observations that cannot be explained except in terms of life being everywhere and life coming in from outside to the Earth. And the resistance is there, and there's no question about it. I think people still like to think that the Earth is supreme as regards life is concerned. We had a very traumatic 2,000 years ago, or 1,500 years ago, we had a traumatic experience accepting that we were not at the center of the physical center of our solar system. And now we sort of cling tenaciously to the possibility that we might be the center of life in the universe. That's the most crazy possibility that we have to entertain. I think there's no chance that that can be right. And as I said, every little bit of evidence that is coming in steadily from the International Space Station, from balloon sampling, from the way that we know that bacteria and viruses can survive in the harshest environments of space and so on, all these new data and developments point to life being a truly cosmic phenomenon, and that that our genes that made you and us and you and all the animals are everywhere in the cosmos.
Well, the thing that kind of annoys me, and I'm certainly a non-scientist. I have a graduate degree in social science, but I don't see that as the same thing as physical science. But nevertheless, one of the things that annoys me is when something is brought forth, and the like this theory, and then the kind of conventional theory is trotted out, and they say, "Well, it's settled science," and I would argue there's very little settled science. To me, it would seem that science is evolving. It's changing, and as new information comes to the fore, the scientist and the literature changes, it evolves, and that really there's very little settled science. Does that seem reasonable to you?
I absolutely agree with you 100%. I think scientists are so arrogant that they think science is absolute and that their present views about the universe are absolute and cannot be changed. And this is something that I think modern scientists are really guilty of insisting upon. And even when evidence is extremely strong, when there has been several smoking guns for the theory of panspermia, and in every instance there's been some ridiculous idea that has been churned out to show how it can be explained in terms of some conventional Earth-based story. For example, I mean, I told you about the microbes discovered on the outside of the International Space Station at 400 kilometers, right? And every theoretical physicist that I've talked about, every atmospheric scientist tells me that there's no way in which a particle of bacteria, a small dust particle, can be lofted through the Earth's atmosphere, stratosphere, ionosphere to reach 400 kilometers. But in spite of that, there are sentences printed in respectable journals saying that there may be electric currents that can pull up these, there are electric fields that can pull up dust particles, bacteria from the surface of the Earth. When you look into the physics of it, it is absolute nonsense. It's illiterate science. And it's like telling people that there's an electric field that is pulling a bacterium upwards, and that electric field is millions of times less than the gravitational pull back to the Earth, and yet it is pulled upwards. It's just stark, raving nonsense. And I think sooner or later, I think people would be ashamed of churning out these ridiculous sort of defenses of an ailing theory. Of course, it's happened before. I think we know that during the last stages of the Copernican Revolution, there were so many epicycles invented to explain how the planets could still appear to move around the sun, but really not move around the sun. There's been so many examples of that in the sort of Middle Ages. I think we are going back into the Middle Ages in terms of a defense of orthodoxy in respect of life in the universe.
Well, if you don't like the score of the game, change the rules.
That's what's happening. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've had a great discussion here with Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe. He is the co-author, along with Robert Bavall, of the book Cosmic Womb, The Seeding of Planet Earth. Doctor, where can people find the book and more information about your work?
Well, I think the book would be everywhere on Amazon and on the websites of the major booksellers. They could also get information from my personal website, which is profchandra.org, P-R-O-F, Chandra, all one word, .org, O-R-G. And so I think that would be a good introduction to the various sources of data that might relate to what we have just been talking about. There's also an astrobiology website at the University of Buckingham. And between these, my personal website, profchandra.org, and the University of Buckingham website, I think you would get all the links and the references.
Excellent. The book is Cosmic Womb, The Seeding of Planet Earth. Our guest has been Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe. Doctor, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that was certainly an interesting discussion, and I think the origin of where we came from, well, I guess it is, isn't it just such a crucial question? And it truly is the greatest ancient mystery. I hope you enjoyed the show. I know I did. We'll talk to you next time and keep exploring those mysteries.